NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In their State of the State addresses this year, Northern New England's governors, along with talking about taxes and jobs, went out of their way to mention rising concerns about heroin addiction, which has reached alarming levels in this part of the country. In January, Vermont's Peter Shumlin drew national attention when he focused almost his entire speech on heroin.
It threatens our safety. It threatens the safety that has always blessed our little state. It's a crisis bubbling just beneath the surface that may be invisible to many, but it's already highly visible to law enforcement, medical personnel, social services, addiction treatment providers, and far too many Vermont families.
Shumlin called for a community-wide response, including greater access to drug treatment. Meanwhile, Maine's Governor Paul LePage, in his State of the State, called for greater law enforcement to combat heroin dealers.
Deaths by drugs is overtaking deaths by car accidents in our state. The use of heroin is increasing. Four times as many people died from a heroin overdose in 2012 than in 2011. Four times more.
And New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan raised concerns on heroin's impact in her address last week.
New Hampshire has among the highest rates in the country of drug and alcohol abuse and dependence, but ranks at the bottom in accessing treatment. Heroin use is on the rise statewide as the leading cause of drug overdose deaths in 2012.
Today in The Exchange, heroin's rise in northern New England. What effects are you seeing in your city or town? What do you think the right response is to this crisis? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. With us in studio is Dr. Ben Nordstrom, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Director of Addiction Services at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And Dr. Nordstrom, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Lieutenant John Encarnaceo. He's a lieutenant with New Hampshire State Police Narcotics Investigations Unit. He's been working for a long time on this problem. And Lieutenant Encarnaceo, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Also with us, Tim Rourke, Director of Program for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, Chair of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Other Drugs. And Tim, welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Laura.
Well.
Happy to be here.
Well, and Tim, I want to start with you. You know, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin called this a crisis bubbling just beneath the surface. What are we seeing now in terms of heroin use here in northern New England and especially New Hampshire?
I think it's actually coming up above the surface at this juncture, and I think we've seen it most acutely in some pretty high-profile situations, particularly the most recent spate of heroin overdoses we've had. You've had Chief Mara in Manchester speaking explicitly about increasing police force in large part because of crime connected specifically to heroin abuse. And so we have, again, I think a circumstance where we've had heroin has been an issue in the state, like all drugs and alcohol, for quite some time, but it is now approaching a really critical level where it's beginning to very publicly impact public safety and health in a way that's really drawing attention to how significant the problem is.
And the overdoses in Portsmouth gained attention, right, Tim, because there were three right near each other, and one person died.
Correct.
And there was a concern that some tainted heroin might have been at the root of this.
Correct. And we've begun to see that in other states in New England as well, that heroin in and of itself is these days is much purer than it has been in the past. However, you complicate that with what is believed to be a rash of tainted heroin that's now hitting the streets that is creating these negative consequences.
So it's bad and it's worse when it's
absolutely
cut with other stuff because you don't know what's in it.
Absolutely.
Anything from fentanyl to rat poison to who knows
sure,
what.
Sure, sure.
Well, and you mentioned crimes connected to heroin abuse, and that's where you come in, I think, Lieutenant Encarnaceo. What are you seeing from the law enforcement end in terms of heroin's impact on New Hampshire?
As far as crime is concerned, a lot of the burglaries we're seeing, the robberies, home invasions, they're all related to this heroin problem. Drug abuse and substance abuse in general is a driving force behind the majority of the crimes that we see committed in the state.
And are the people committing these crimes, are they in the throes of, you know, addiction, or are they seeking money to continue to fuel that addiction?
Sometimes both, but for the most part, they're trying to continue the addiction. They don't necessarily want to, but they physically have to. And with the heroin, they'll do anything possible to get that next fix, and that leads to the problems.
When people are under the influence of heroin, are they typically violent, Lieutenant Encarnacio?
No, not typically, but they are. It's after that period of being high, you know, the paranoia or the need to get high again is really what drives them to commit the crimes, to obtain, you know, additional funding or money. Some people are driven to becoming a dealer, selling, you know, to their friends or other users to support their own habit. Other people aren't surrounded by, you know, a lot of people that they can sell to, and they'll turn to crime, whether it's breaking into cars in the neighborhood or breaking into buildings or doing a robbery at a convenience store.
So a sort of desperation sets in.
Exactly.
You know, and speaking of some of the time that heroin addicts become dealers, who typically is abusing heroin, Dr. Nordstrom? Is there a typical profile? Vermont Governor Shumlin said in his speech, we didn't play this part, but he said it's not just, you know, the other, this sort of person who's always had trouble and kind of lives on the margins of society.
Yeah, absolutely. Addiction really does cut across all socioeconomic groups. It really doesn't distinguish based on education or wealth. Anyone can get addicted potentially. And so we certainly see that in clinical practice. People from all walks of life are subject to developing an addiction like this.
How do they come to this addiction? And obviously, every single person has their own story. But what are some of the typical ways that someone, you know, no one wakes up and says, gee, I think I'll become a heroin addict today. I mean, how does this happen?
Well, in this area, what we frequently see are people actually get into the opioids through the pharmaceutical opiates that are out there. You know, whether we're talking about Percocet or OxyContin or one of those kinds of drugs. And people develop a habit on those because tolerance develops really pretty quickly with these. And so people need more and more of the drug in order to feel high. And then eventually what happens is their body habituates to the presence of the drug, and then they go into withdrawal, like the lieutenant was saying, without it. And so then they get caught in this sort of pincer movement between having to use more drugs to get high and needing to use drugs to stop from going into withdrawal. And their habit can get very expensive. And what we've seen is people actually are shifting to heroin because heroin is cheaper per unit dose than the pharmaceutical opiate products. And so a lot of the people in this area are using heroin basically out of economic desperation.
Yeah, and I know that this is often said to be fueling the rise, right, Tim, that people were addicted to prescription drugs, and then those got expensive. The state started to crack down on availability, so they switched to heroin. Go ahead.
Correct, and that's been the pattern that we've seen across the country, particularly as prescription drug abuse has risen so dramatically, and states and localities have been pretty aggressive in establishing policies around prescription drug take-back and law enforcement interventions that are making prescription drugs more difficult to get or more expensive. And for those who are in the heroin business, they've been able to produce at a cheaper opiate. And so they have been able to sort of move in where prescription drug abuse has been high and there's been success dropping it. The heroin has moved in to take its place. And I think that's the challenge with substance abuse in general is that, you know, heroin is a significant issue today. 2 years ago, it was prescription drugs. 2 years from now, hopefully it won't be heroin, but it will probably be something else. So it's a challenge.
Well, and it kind of makes you think, you know, where does it stop, Lieutenant Encarnacio? I mean, it's like a game of whack-a-mole because 2-3 years ago, we were doing a lot of shows on prescription drug abuse. Now we're talking about heroin because of those reasons that Tim and Dr. Nordstrom outlined. How do you even begin to attend to that? I mean, you hit one problem and another one jumps up.
It's got to be a partnership amongst everybody involved, the medical community, the general public, law enforcement, education. Everybody has to do their part. And when one of those components breaks down, you know, we allow it to become more of a problem quicker.
It must be very frustrating for you, though. You know, you tackle one end and you seem to get a little bit of a handle on it, and then this other thing pops up.
It can be. It's a challenge, to say the least. But like I said, working together, it makes you feel good when you are able to make strides against this.
Well, and I definitely want to ask all of you about that working together, the different roles that everyone can play. Our number here on The Exchange for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. And could we talk a little bit more, Dr. Nordstrom, about addiction? Because clearly, you know, Lieutenant Encarnacio is right. If people don't get addicted, then we won't have this problem. How easy is it to get addicted to heroin?
Relatively, it's one of the more addictive drugs that's out there, second really only to nicotine in terms of the percent of people who try a drug who then go on to develop an addiction to it. But the thing to remember about addiction is that really what's happening is we have created substances that hijack our natural reward circuit in our brain, that we have neurocircuitry that's designed to keep us doing the things that keep our species alive, whether that's eating, drinking water, reproducing, nurturing our young, that those are all things that activate a natural reward circuit. And the problem with people is that we're too clever by half, and we've found ways to actually cultivate and refine drugs that hijack that reward circuit. So in a very real sense, we sort of have this Achilles heel built into the base of our brain that is going to leave us susceptible to this kind of thing.
Can you explain that a little bit more? I'm not quite sure where you're going with that. So the drugs enhance that rewarded feeling?
Is that what you're saying? The drugs actually activate that same reward circuit, but they activate it much more strongly than any of the natural rewards that we have available to us, you know, in sort of our pristine natural sense, you know, the amount of reward we get from eating a good meal or the rewards that we get from drinking when we're very thirsty is just infinitesimally small relative to the amount of reward we get when we use drugs.
So the heroin makes that rewarded feeling a whole lot better, a whole lot quicker.
And it absolutely hijacks that circuit.
Okay, Tim, I have another question for you too in just a moment. More conversation about Northern New England's growing heroin problem coming up. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Sign up your team for NHPR's second annual Trivia Smackdown. Flex your memory for minutia, and maybe you could be this year's champ. Spaces fill up quickly, so visit nhpr.org now to enter your team. This event made possible in part by NEEPCO and the Common Man family of restaurants. New Hampshire weather, winter storm warning in effect for all of the state till mid-morning tomorrow. Total accumulations from 8 to 12 inches for most of the state, 3 to 6 inches along the coast. Snow today, heavy at times, windy, highs upper 20s to around 30 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, M from Revision Energy in Exeter, a local business specializing in the design, installation, and service of solar energy systems. More information online at revisionenergy.com. And the Colonial Theater in Keene presenting the Chieftains in an early celebration of St. Patrick's Day on Tuesday, March 11th at 7:30. Tickets and information at thecolonial.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, heroin's rise in northern New England. Let's hear from you. What effects are you seeing in your city or town? What questions do you have about this drug and its impact on our communities here in New Hampshire? And what do you think the right response to combat this addiction epidemic is? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Tim Rourke, I did want to talk to you too just about the addictive quality of heroin. Mm-hmm. People talk about casual drinking. They talk about recreational use of marijuana. Can you be a recreational heroin user?
No. And I think, you know, Dr. Nordstrom's description of how it hijacks the reward system in the brain is really why that's the case, because the high that you get is so high. And once that reward system is accustomed to that level of increase in the high that it gives off, the reward that it gives off, there is anything less than that kind of gets killed and dulled. So with heroin, you get a physical addiction that is almost immediate. And so where there are, certainly there's alcohol use where there can be a trajectory where people, whether it's because of genetic predisposition or other factors in their life, over time can develop an addiction to alcohol. Same is true for many other drugs. But drugs like heroin, for a lot of opiates, the window of time it takes for the body to become so accustomed to what it does to the body that the body asks for more of it is much, much shorter.
So you can't even really say heroin use and abuse. It's all abuse.
Yeah.
What are you seeing, Lieutenant Encarnacio, in terms of, you know, the people who are using heroin, the addicts that you encounter, in terms of just their whole way of being and their whole way of feeling and their whole way of reacting when they're under the influence, so to speak?
Well, a lot of times the people that we come into contact with is as a result of an arrest, law enforcement intervention. And I can tell you that a number of people that have been taken into custody while they're committing a crime, or, you know, they're caught with the heroin and they are high. I can tell you we've seen the withdrawals. They show up in court the next morning, and I've seen occasions where the individual has had to be brought out of the courtroom because they are physically sick and the judge does not want them in there.
Wow. because
that's how strong the withdrawal is. And that's, you know, over 12 hours, you know, course of time, you know, that they are need medical attention. On the other hand, like I said, a lot of times we come into contact with people because of an investigation, a search warrant. We've recently done a number of search warrants where we go into what used to be a crack house, now is a heroin house, and you have a, you know, apartment complex or a building with five or six apartments, and there are, you know, junkies living in every single apartment. And, you know, one person is making a trip down to Lawrence, bringing back the heroin, supplying everybody there, including themselves. And, you know, the problem just continues. It's a cycle. When we have come into contact with a number of these people, they are all very cooperative and they have a problem.
And they know it.
They know it. What we have been told is, you know, they're trying to get help or they're looking for some outlet to intervene, you know, so they can get off the drugs. And unfortunately, there's not a lot out there right now. We are the source of intervention. And unfortunately, a lot of times that means putting somebody in handcuffs and bringing them to, you know, before the court and eventually into the criminal justice system.
Yeah, that's the treatment issue that we should definitely talk about. And I've heard, Lieutenant Encarnacio, that the moment, it might have even been Peter Shumlin who said this, the governor of Vermont, the moment where it's best to get people into treatment is when those blue lights are flashing. When they are in that crisis, they're under arrest.
Yeah, they're motivated at that point.
All right. Let's go to our listeners, and then I have another question for you too, Dr. Nordstrom. Our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, concerns are welcome about Northern New England's growing heroin problem. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Becky's waiting in Hopkinton. Hi, Becky. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask your guest, I'm an obstetrician, and over the past 10 years or so, I have seen a huge increase in the number of pregnant women who are dealing with opioid addictions. And I'm wondering if your guest can talk a little bit about what's going on in New Hampshire to treat these women and what some of the consequences are for their babies.
Yeah, and Becky, you're probably aware Governor LePage in Maine especially focused on the babies in his State of the State address.
Yeah.
I think I'll throw that to you, Dr. Nordstrom, first, but I know you've got some thoughts, Tim Moore.
Sure. Thanks for your call, and thanks for your work with these women. We know firsthand that this is a real, real problem. There's a number of things that we're trying to do because we have also experienced this problem with an increase in opioid-addicted women who are pregnant. And one of the things that we've done at Dartmouth-Hitchcock is create a specific perinatal addiction treatment program, which is a group specifically for pregnant moms, where they come in and there's groups and therapy that are designed around the specific needs of this group. We have Suboxone available for them. We have
What is that, Suboxone?
Suboxone buprenorphine. It is a medication that's kind of like methadone. It can be used to treat opioid addiction.
I see. And doesn't hurt the fetus, I guess.
And doesn't hurt the fetus. It protects them. And studies show it has much better outcomes than leaving people untreated. In addition, we've got integrated services with the obstetrics department that they've been tremendous partners with this, as well as our partners in pediatrics, the intensive care nursery. We have services that really kind of teach these women about what's going to happen after their baby's delivered. The intensivists in the neonatal unit come down and meet with the women. So we've got this really kind of good integrated service. We're offering some prenatal care in our addiction clinic just because sometimes they don't make it to their OB appointments. And so one of the great things is that Tim's group has been generous enough to partner with us as well and help fund some research where we are collecting outcomes data here to make sure that we're on the right track.
Well, and you said something I want to follow up on, Dr. Nordstrom, and not to pick on you, but you said, you know, we have a program where they come in and get treatment. Where they come in, how do you get them to come in? I mean, I'm guessing someone who's pregnant and using heroin,
well, exactly,
you know,
like,
may not have their act together to come in.
Absolutely. And so that's where we partner with people like The Caller. The obstetricians in our medical center are doing what's called screening and brief intervention and referral to treatment now under an initiative spearheaded by one of my colleagues, Kathy Milliken. And what we're doing then is asking these women about their drug using behavior and identifying the ones who need to come into treatment. So what we're trying to do is expand our efforts to detect these folks and then create a program where we can actually address their needs.
Sounds like you got to get out of the office and get out in the community and see what the needs are.
Right.
I have one more question for you about babies. I remember in the 80s when crack cocaine was really taking over in Washington, D.C., where I was working as a reporter at the time, and I covered the crack baby unit mm-hmm. at one of the hospitals. And it just broke my heart. And the nurses there said that, you know, these kids were really going to struggle perhaps for their whole lives, at least through early childhood and maybe their whole lives. I wonder what we know about heroin babies.
Well, what we know is that the babies can develop something called the neonatal abstinence syndrome, where essentially the babies go into withdrawal because they've been exposed to the drug while they're in utero.
So they want it too.
And so they come out and exactly, they withdraw from it.
Yikes.
The same as exactly what the lieutenant was saying about people withdrawing in the courtrooms. The same thing happens with the newborns. And they can actually stay in the intensive care unit for up to a couple of weeks after they're born. So they get a really rough start and they stay in the hospital. And so that's what we're trying to do by getting them on one of these medications that can really attenuate the risk of developing that neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Go ahead, Tim, and then I'm going to go back to our listeners.
Well, I was going to add, I think your question is an important one relative to the issue of getting them in the door. You know, I think the program that Dr. Nordstrom and his team are working on is something we need a lot more of, and I've talked with a lot of medical facilities that are really beginning to think about that. But there is the issue of stigma and fear, particularly of women not choosing to go to seek prenatal care because
well, sure.
they're
what
afraid.
What if I get arrested?
What if I get arrested? Will they take my child away? And so we're also hearing from a lot of doctors for whom, you know, a child is being born with neonatal abstinence syndrome because the first time the mom gets into a medical environment is when she walks into the hospital to deliver. So I think part of it is also raising awareness, creating programs that are safe and encouraging of women who are pregnant or could become pregnant who are using heroin or opiates to recognize that that's an issue and seek the assistance that they need when they can get it. Because for hospitals, as Dr. Nordstrom alluded, you know, there's significant cost because for a child born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, their stay in the hospital is far extended. You know, and the Department of Health and Human Services has done some analysis that, you know, there's significant cost to Medicaid because of the number of NAS babies being born to parents who are in the Medicaid system. So in addition to the challenges that it gives a baby at the early start and the challenges to the mom and their health, there's just the simple cost of what that does in terms of complicating the pregnancy.
So they don't often seek the help before the baby's born because
Correct.
They're afraid that A, they'll get arrested, B, the baby will be taken away. This is a really tricky question, and I don't know if you know, Tim. What happens when a baby is born to a heroin-addicted mother? How do people sort out whether that child should go home with that mother or not?
Well, I think it's probably a case-by-case basis, pretty complicated, particularly if there is the ability, and I'll let Dr. Nordstrom correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think being able to assess the extent to which the mom is able to access treatment, does the experience of giving birth, is that a trigger that drives the mom into treatment? Is there a wraparound of services that could be provided? I also think that's the ideal, whether or not that's actually happening in other parts of the state where a program like Dr. Nordstrom's may not exist is an open question.
Do you want to jump in real quick there, Dr.
Sure.
Nordstrom?
I mean, really, that concern, while I understand where it comes from, it shouldn't deter anyone from seeking treatment. That really, ultimately, the best thing they can do for themselves and their baby is to get into treatment. And really, everybody wants to work to keep moms and babies together, and a mom who's doing everything she can, that's going to be recognized.
Let's take another call if we could. Becky, thank you very much for that one. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Terry's calling from Rochester. Hi, Terry. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
How are you, Laura?
Fine.
This is Dr. Bennett. I run a Suboxone clinic, amongst other things, in a general practice. And there were a couple of interesting articles in the Union Leader that not heard either of your experts mention. One is that there is a genetic deformation, if you will, that predisposes us to be addicts and or alcoholics. And that is hard to overcome. You have to be abstinent from the beginning, because if you try, you fly. Second thing is that the brighter the kid, the more likely they are to experiment with drugs, in my experience, and in the experience of the article writer in the Union Leader, because they've gotten away with other stuff, and they think they're going to get away with this. Finally, I run a Suboxone and Zubsolve, which is the newest iteration of buprenorphine clinic. You're allowed to have 100 patients. We have 100. I try as hard as I can to talk people into tapering down and getting off, but my graduation rate is less than 1%.
Wow.
And this stuff is really expensive. So at some point, we're, as a society, spending a fortune. And it does not seem to be producing results. The other interesting dynamic that I tend to see is that if you, and this runs in my family, okay, my father was an alcoholic and an addict and a really marvelous physician, but he had troubles all of his life. My mom was in and out of drugs. So this genetic tends to predispose everybody, and if you have the genetic, you pick somebody else with the genetic, and that's who you make babies with. So I see family history stretching back as far as you can look, either alcohol or drug addiction.
Wow, because the cycle continues because of that family lineage. So many points, Terry. Thank you so much for calling. And Lieutenant Encarnacio, I'm curious about one thing he said. If you try, you fly. I wonder what you see among the people that you encounter, some people who never thought they would get addicted, and all of a sudden there they are.
I don't think anyone who tries it thinks they're going to get addicted. I think that there's a lot of truth to that statement, and like the doctor said, it really is an individual type thing. One person may use it two or three times and not become addicted. Another person may use it that one time and they turn into a full-blown addict within a month.
We've heard some terminology from Terry and also from all of you. Suboxone, I think you mentioned it too. There's another drug too, right, Dr. Nordstrom, that can be used when someone is literally on death's door, almost ready to die of a heroin overdose. And then there's another drug that you can give this person and all of a sudden their eyelids start to open.
Absolutely. What you're talking about is a drug called naloxone.
That's
or
it.
Narcan. And that is a reversal agent that essentially gets to those same opioid receptors where the heroin or the other opiates are bound. And it kind of like a little crowbar pops the drug off that receptor and replaces it. And so it just takes people out of that high and reverses the effects of the drug.
And I've heard people's lives literally being saved. They're
on
death's door.
Yes. And seen it many times. Yeah.
Do you have this in your toolkit, Lieutenant Encarnacio? I mean, is it to the point where police are actually carrying this?
We do not. The state police do not. We'll get medical professionals involved if we encounter somebody that is in that dire condition. Usually it's, through EMS, or we get them to the hospital, and that's where we see it being used.
Got it. Go ahead.
There's more interest in the country, different places, of actually at needle exchange programs where people are given clean needles to try to reduce the frequency of bloodborne infections in this population, of actually training the opiate addicts themselves and how to administer naloxone and giving them naloxone to take with them in case they overdose or a friend overdoses.
How do you feel about that, Tim? I mean, you could say you're almost encouraging the behavior by saying you can take it and look, we'll give you this thing so you'll be okay.
Well, it's interesting because that's actually the conversation ongoing in the state of Maine right now, that the governor is there's legislation in the state of Maine to make naloxone more widely available through multiple channels, including what Dr. Nordstrom just spoke of. And I know the governor is not in favor of that. However, based on the sort of thought that perhaps it will increase people's heroin use or think that it's okay to take the risk because there's a way out, science is not suggesting that that's a behavior that's being manifest in states that have done that kind of work, whether it's giving naloxone to needle exchange programs or law enforcement or making sure that it's being carried in EMT ambulances. So I would expect in most states that's a legislative conversation around making that access available. I think the other point that the doctor raised, however, is another one to hover on, because there's naloxone and then there is Suboxone and pharmacological agents that can be used to treat addiction. We have a very limited capacity to provide medication-assisted therapy in New Hampshire because, as you heard, for most doctors who are able to prescribe, they're limited to the number of patients that they can see and do that prescribing with. And that, I think, is a challenge because it creates limited opportunities for treatment for many of whom that kind of medication-assisted therapy would actually be more effective than other forms of just talk therapy or residential treatment without that kind of assistance.
So there are drugs that help you, again, return from death's door, so to speak, but then the other drugs you mentioned, Tim, actually help you get over your addiction.
Correct, correct. And we certainly, like many, you know, we have methadone clinics in the state that are designed as well to provide medication-assisted therapy to give them something that helps them function normally without the high. But these other drugs like Suboxone, which are showing promise, again, they don't work for everybody and they can be abused. I mean, they're not foolproof, but access to those is an issue in the state that we're aware it's quite limited.
Well, and in her State of the State address, Governor Hassan said that access to treatment was quite limited. I wonder what you're seeing, Tim.
We have capacity to treat between 4% and 6% of the addicted population in New Hampshire through the publicly financed treatment system. I think what is very exciting right now is the potential for the expansion of healthcare access through the Senate compromise around what's been called Medicaid expansion, because with the Affordable Care Act came a provision known as parity, which means that insurances have to cover substance abuse treatment, whereas before they did not.
And so that's new, yeah.
That's new, and it will open up the doors and resources, hopefully, to thousands of people who need treatment who couldn't have afforded it otherwise.
More conversation about Northern New England, heroin addiction, rising rates, and your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new research strongly questions the value of regular mammograms. Then exploring the mysteries of the human heart with the editor of the New York Times column, Modern Love. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, winter storm warning in effect for all of the state till tomorrow mid-morning. Total accumulations from 8 to 12 inches for most of the state, 3 to 6 inches along the coast. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Pax World Mutual Funds, a leader in sustainable investing, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making, paxworld.com for tomorrow. And UNH Manchester hosting a winter open house Saturday, February 15th. More information online at manchester.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're taking another look at heroin's alarming rise here in northern New England. And we want to know what you're seeing in your city or town and what you think the right response to this crisis is. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And Veronica's waiting in Bedford. Hi, Veronica. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I have a concern about what's not happening in our schools to prevent these drugs from being solicited to our youth, as well as what the youth are doing to obtain the drugs. Unfortunately, we have some friends that have a young daughter who's become addicted and has started selling herself to obtain the drugs. How are these drugs getting into our schools, and what can be done about it?
That's a great question, Veronica. Thank you. Lieutenant Encarnacio, I'll go to you first.
Well, I don't know specifically what this individual is addicted to, but I'll tell you what we see as a major problem, and that has been the prescription drugs, the easy access. You know, we see a lot more youth using the prescription drugs and able to obtain them. And I go back to thinking, you know, when I was in high school and college and what I saw and what people were using, what people were doing. Prescription drugs, you know, nobody thinks they're going to become a heroin addict when they start taking prescription drugs. And a lot of times, you know, these kids are using the prescription drugs. They don't have any kind of pain. They're taking it to get high. They think, well, I just eat this pill and I get the feeling that I want. Next thing, they're eating two pills. Then they're eating four. Then they're eating six a day. Now you got an addiction problem. Before long, that person who was a, you know, a straight-A student 6 months ago has now developed into a prescription drug addict and eventually turns into a heroin addict. They start snorting heroin. They start smoking heroin. And finally, they, you know, they start injecting heroin. And you have a 18-year-old, you know, girl that was due to graduate, and now she's a heroin junkie. Those are the types of things that we're seeing.
It's terrifying. And I know you want to jump in, Dr. Nordstrom and Tim, too. But another question for you. You know, Veronica wondered what schools could do. Could they do more? There's a lot of pressure on schools to do a lot these days. But I wonder what you think, what you see schools doing and what they could do more of.
Again, I think the real way to combat this problem is a partnership with everybody at the table, including parents, and it has to start at home. And I understand that there are some homes that, you know, single parent, no parent, that there are a lot of problems in the home that can lead some child astray. But it really has to start there. And when it doesn't, yeah, it makes it a little bit tougher. But with education and law enforcement and the medical community, everybody sitting down at the table and putting their heads together, I think that's the way to really make some progress in this and make a difference.
Dr. Nordstrom, go ahead. Veronica, great question. Thank you.
Thanks, Veronica. And just to build off what the lieutenant said, what the parents can do, what we all can do, is look at what's in our medicine cabinet. That ultimately, where these drugs are finding their way into the system, most of the time, when you look at the data collected by the federal government in the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, is most of the pharmaceutical opiates that are leaking into our communities are coming from our own medicine cabinets. It's not drug dealers. It's not some nefarious organization. It's the fact that you get prescribed 30 Percocet after you get a tooth pulled. You use five. You have 25 left over sitting in your medicine cabinet. Those get stolen, lost, obtained, and they find their way into the community. If you have leftover opiates that you are not using and do not need, take them to your police station in your area and dispose of them like that, because that's really where these
drugs
are coming
from. Don't flush them down the toilet. Don't put them in the trash.
Don't put them in the trash, because that's, yeah, not very secure. When you put it down the toilet, it unfortunately gets into the groundwater. The best way to get rid of them is to take them to the police station.
You know, Tim, getting back to Veronica's point about schools, are they on the lookout enough for this stuff? Again, we know schools are under a lot of pressure these days, but are they looking for red flag behaviors? And when they see them, what do they do about it?
I think they are, and they're doing the best they can with the resources and the pressures that they're under. I think, you know, in the state of New Hampshire, we have a regional prevention network system where there are 13 – the state's broken into 13 regions. And in each region, there's a substance abuse prevention specialist who's doing some of that partnership work that the lieutenant has spoken about, bringing together law enforcement, schools, and the healthcare community, and helping those various places that touch the lives of young people think about and build in programs and policies that look for these kinds of issues. And I think it's also important to recognize, particularly for schools and for young people, that, you know, we're talking about specifically heroin, which is an incredibly dangerous, highly addictive drug. The usage rates around heroin use with young people are not large. You know, for young people, it's opiate addiction, marijuana, and alcohol, in that order from least to most. And so
opiate,
I think
being
opiates,
the pills again.
You know, prescription drugs, a little bit, I think. But we have, you know, alcohol and marijuana where we have some of the highest youth use in the country. So this is an important issue to know, because there is the connection between, as the doctor outlined, you know, opiates to heroin use or things of that nature. But with young people, it's important to really think much more broadly about drugs and alcohol in general, because heroin is actually the least of youth's worries when it comes to youth use. The challenge, of course, here is that as well, you know, this is not a school issue. You know, this is a drug that's available in the community. Whether or not it comes on school grounds, that's only part of the solution. And so that's why I think these coalitions, both local and regional coalitions in the state, and schools plugging into those coalitions is really, really critical to give them the support that they need.
Veronica, thanks again for joining us. And Lieutenant Encarnacio, Veronica mentioned her friend's daughter, who, again, became an addict and is now dealing to support that habit. I wonder, how do you see the breakdown of the heroin dealers, you know, those who are, you know, sick and addicted, versus those who may be just dealing as a business venture? Who do you really see as the bad guys when it comes to the heroin dealers?
Well, the unit that I command with the state police, the Narcotics Investigation Unit, we target mid to upper level dealers. And you know, all this stuff is bad, but the real bad guys that we see and we deal with are the mid to upper level dealers. The dealer that, you know, is in the community, that's supplying their own habit, and yeah, we do investigations into those people because they're a problem. They're distributing to other individuals, and you know, we want to take those people off the street. But we make a big difference by going after that person that's bringing quantity into the state, a quantity into the community. And a lot of times those people they're right here in the state. You know, we don't have, you know, people coming from overseas or out of state, or, you know, they aren't the only ones that are profiting from dealing drugs, particularly heroin. But those are the bad guys. The guy that is making money and putting the money away, and they're not addicted, and they're putting the poison into the community. Those are the bad guys. Those are the ones that we want to target.
So it isn't just, you know, coming in from Massachusetts or New York or D.C. Or Canada. You know, who knows? It's also homegrown, the bad guys.
They are. But unfortunately, like I said, that's just the way it is. It's coming from somewhere. You know, heroin doesn't grow here. You know, poppies,
opium poppies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't grow here in New Hampshire. It has to get here somehow. And, yeah, it's coming through the major cities on the East Coast. It's making its way into New Hampshire from Lawrence, from Lowell, from Worcester, you know, from New York City, Connecticut. You know, it's coming to New Hampshire via these other locations. When it gets here, we still have major distributors right here in New Hampshire that are sending it out into the community, that are profiting from it without themselves being addicted.
All right. Here's an email that came in from Jesse in Dover, who says, why is it that no public service ads or media is utilized showing vivid depictions of addicts, deaths, family destructions, etc.? Jesse says celebrities could be utilized to condemn usage as well. Jesse, it's a great question. Tim, I'll throw that to you.
Sure. Actually, there is going to be quite soon. It was supposed to be today, but due to the weather, it's been postponed. But the Partnership for a Drug-Free New Hampshire is going to be announcing in the next couple of months the first statewide media campaign coordinated in state to really raise awareness around drug and alcohol abuse, really targeting parents, interestingly, given the earlier caller's question, to really just help raise awareness to the fact that there is a problem. You know, very often shock campaigns where you sort of show, you know, the horrors of use are
car crashes in
right,
driver's ed programs.
You know, they are immediately shocking to look at and provocative, but in the end, they don't typically, research suggests, they don't typically lead to behavior change.
Really?
Right. So part of what I know the campaign that's going to come out will do is really raise awareness of how significant the drug and alcohol problem is in New Hampshire, because not a lot of people realize how significant it is. And then use that as a launching pad to direct people to where can they go to get help? What are the tips for parents? What are the tips for schools and law enforcement? And use it to really start the conversation. So that, I think, will probably launch now in March.
Yeah. And Dr. Nordstrom, to you, what do you find typically does get folks back on the right path? You know, someone mentioned when that mother gives birth, for example, she might say, you know, I need to clean up my act for my child. What else tends to get people serious about seeking treatment and serious about getting it?
You know, unfortunately, usually something negative has to happen. You know, that there has to be some consequences build up to the point that people can't sort of pretend that this use isn't causing problems.
There's an arrest.
Lives.
Like
an arrest
Lieutenant
is a great
about.
Example. And a lot of people have the misconception that if you get coerced into treatment by the criminal justice system, that's just not going to work because people aren't ready. The truth of the matter is coerced treatments work just as well as non-coerced treatments. And that ultimately people come to treatment because something is making their use untenable. And it could be their spouse threatening to leave them. It could be losing their job. It could be legal consequences. It could be, DCYF threatening to take their children away. Something has to happen that makes people decide that they need to change.
And is that, the criminal justice system, is that where most people get their treatment, Dr. Nordstrom? I mean, we mentioned earlier how skinny the state-sponsored treatment system is. So where do most people get it?
So the criminal justice system is certainly a route in, and there are a lot of very excellent drug courts running in the state of New Hampshire under the leadership of Judge Tina Nadeau. So that is certainly a route in. That's not the majority of the people in treatment in this state, that there are lots of treatment providers that are doing what they can. But unfortunately, because of the things that Tim was talking about, we just don't have, without the funding, without the parity at this point, it's hard to make a program that's sustainable. But certainly there are programs where
and that could change due to the private insurance changes that Tim talked about.
Hopefully, yes.
Well, and speaking of drug courts, here's an email from Rick who says, drug courts are an important component to addressing the heroin problem of our state. When I served 15 years as a prosecutor, drug court was the best response I ever saw that actually worked to combat addiction and reduce recidivism. Rick says, in Grafton County, we have had many successes with our drug court. Lieutenant Encarnacio, I wonder what your experiences have been with drug court or just the ways that maybe police try to get people into treatment.
Well, first, I would have to agree with the comment made via email that, that a lot of times the drug courts are very successful. Again, in regards to the treatment, sometimes the problem you run into is the resources and the funding to continue somebody's treatment. You know, to check somebody in for 30 days is great, but when they need 90 days of treatment, you know, that 30 days helps out and they're back on the street, and before long they're back into whatever drug or whatever problem that they had before. Unfortunately, I haven't dealt that much with the drug court because, again, the unit that I run is mid to upper level dealers.
Right.
So they're not going to drug court. They're going to superior court, and hopefully after that, their next stop is the state prison.
Yeah, your hope is to put them away so that they'll stop dealing.
That's right.
Right. Here's an email that came in, a heartbreaking email from a person who asked that their name not be used, and of course we'll respect that. This person says, I have a couple of comments. My son is a recovering heroin addict, 21 years old, clean for 2 years. One of your callers commented that bright young children tend to experiment with drugs. This was very true in my son's situation. He comes from middle-class educated parents, grew up in a rural area with lots of sunshine and exercise. I am sure that he thought he could never become addicted. My second comment is this. He ended up in the hospital with an overdose and started his rehab there. So there's that crisis, Dr. Nordstrom, that got him into rehab. Getting him into a Suboxone program was incredibly difficult. He was in the right frame of mind to work on this addiction. We had to search the state for a doctor that did not have a waiting list. He had to drive over an hour to get his medication. I think people should also understand that Suboxone is difficult to stop. Also, it took my son a year to taper off. This person concludes by saying heroin addiction is still not an acceptable disease. Thank you so, so much for sharing this story. And Tim Work, this gets again to the issue of drug treatment. Here's a young man who wants to get over this. And he's, you know, it's not easy for him.
Right. And amen to the caller or to the emailer. And thank you for raising that story. You know, I think we would never, as a society, tolerate someone with a cancer diagnosis being denied treatment or being told, you know, you can't get it or you have to pay for it out of your own pocket, or to get it you have to travel 1,000 miles. You know, we, with most other diseases, we as a society expect and demand and receive unfettered access to the treatment we need for those kinds of illnesses. Addiction is not there yet. And, you know, there is a need, and I quote Congressman Patrick Kennedy, who was in the state a few weeks ago, who said, you know, we've got to start thinking about the head being attached to the rest of the body from a health perspective. And I think part of the work of the Governor's Commission that I chair with other partners is thinking about how do we take advantage of new ways to finance treatment through these healthcare reform efforts to expand treatment access, because there needs to be more of it. And because of the nature of treatment of addiction, that when the moment is right, sometimes, again, the person is ready because a negative consequence has happened. There's a law enforcement lever that has been pulled that can coerce them in. But sometimes there's another sort of dark night of the soul that drives a person to say, I'm ready, I need help. And if you are not there in that moment, it will do far more harm than good. And so I think we as a state really need to look at how do we make treatment available at the right time for the right person in the right way without delay, because this is a disease that will kill people if it goes untreated.
All right. All of you, sobering conversation. Thank you so much for being here. Tim Rourke, it was really good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Tim Rourke, Director of Program for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, Chair of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drugs. Lieutenant Encarnacio, it was great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
That's Lieutenant John Encarnacio, Lieutenant with New Hampshire's State Police Narcotics Investigations Unit. And Dr. Nordstrom, thank you for making the trip. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me back.
That's Dr. Ben Nordstrom, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Director of Addiction Services at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our intern is Nate Graby. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The House soundly defeats a bill to expand background checks for gun purchases. An explosion at the New Hampshire Ball Bearings plant in Peterborough sends more than a dozen workers to the hospital. And the Granite State's official state dog, the Chinook, makes its first appearance at the Westminster Dog Show. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. Winter storm warning is in effect for all of New Hampshire till tomorrow mid-morning. Total accumulations of 8 to 12 inches for most of the state, 3 to 6 inches along the coast. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Edward Jones, a financial services firm serving individuals and business owners. Edward Jones, making sense of investing, a member of SIPC. And the HNH Foundation honoring National Children's Dental Health Month. Over 43% of third graders in New Hampshire experience tooth decay. More at hnhfoundation.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It is 10 o'clock.
AMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. 100 stories a week, 52 weeks a year for nearly 10 years. That's how many essays Daniel Jones has read about love. As editor of the popular Modern Love column in the New York Times, Jones has curated a decade-long conversation